New Orleans is widely considered the birthplace of the Italian-American Mafia, and for much of its history, the New Orleans family had a lot of power in the South. I'm Brian McCoy. Welcome to The Mob Files. Okay, everyone, welcome into episode 3 of The Mob Files. Today, our subject is the New Orleans crime family. This will be a broad overview of the history of the family. There are a lot of subjects and people involved in the New Orleans family where we could dive into the details a lot more. I plan on doing some additional episodes where I'll do that, but for today, we'll focus on the major events and people throughout its history. New Orleans is thought to be the birthplace of the Italian-American Mafia. Italian organized crime factions have operated in the area since the 1860s at least, and the first published account of Mafia activity came from there. The New Orleans Times newspaper in 1869 reported on a group of Sicilians who had formed an organization to commit crimes within the city. As in many cities, the early operations in New Orleans were of the Black Hand variety. Black Hand refers to an extortion method in which a letter was sent to a victim demanding money under threat of physical harm or harm to a business. This was a common tactic of early Italian criminals. They didn't have the political influence and power of the later, better organized families. They couldn't infiltrate institutions to run their rackets, so they had to rely largely on extortion, and their primary targets were other Italians. As you will hear, the New Orleans family later transformed into what comes to mind of a more modern crime family, using political capital and influence to get what they wanted. But this had to be built up over decades. The early days of organized crime in New Orleans were very bloody, and two opposing factions were at war from almost the very beginning. Raffaele Aniello, a Sicilian immigrant, established operations in the New Orleans area shortly after the Civil War. He wanted to consolidate power and initiated conflict with other Italian gangs in the New Orleans area who did not associate with his crew. The dividing lines between these crews were largely based on what specific parts of Sicily the members had originated from. Aniello was successful in initiating an ongoing conflict between his group and pretty much every other gangster in New Orleans. Aniello himself did not last long in this war. He was murdered in April 1869. Joseph Aniello, Raffaele's brother, took over the organization and kept the conflict going. Joseph didn't fare much better than his brother. After surviving multiple attempts on his life, Joseph was killed in April 1972. In the 1870s, another set of brothers, Charles and Antonio Matrenga, began operating in New Orleans as well. Brothers made their money off of other Italians using the Black Hand method I described earlier, forcing them to pay to avoid having their livelihoods and businesses disrupted. At that point, the two main factions were the Matrangas and the Aniellos. In the late 70s and early 80s, the Aniello faction was taken over by the Provenzano family. The Provenzanos had been a prominent family in Sicily and decided to move their operations to the US. The Provenzanos controlled labor at the New Orleans docks and made their money by taking a cut there. They quickly became the Matrangas' chief rival. The two factions went to war in the 1880s and 90s, battling for turf in the city. The boiling point of the feud came when the Matrangas successfully forced their way into the docks, striking a serious blow to the Provenzanos, and they never really recovered from this. The New Orleans Police Department turned its attention to the feud in 1890. Shortly thereafter, Police Chief David Hennessy was murdered while walking home. There are many theories as to why he was killed, but one prominent one is that he had obtained information that would be incriminating for the Matrangas, so they took him out. There are also rumors of the exact opposite occurring, that he had obtained incriminating evidence against the Provenzanos, and so they had him taken out. Regardless, Hennessy's murder enraged the community, and after several prominent people in the community started spreading the word that the murder was carried out by the Mafia, it sparked ill feelings toward Italians. Many Italians were rounded up and arrested during the investigation. Some put the number in the hundreds. Ultimately, 19 people were actually indicted for the murder, including Charles Matrenga. There were trials held for 9 of the defendants, but no one was convicted. The people of New Orleans were outraged by the murder and what they viewed as the lack of justice following it, and eventually they took matters into their own hands. On March 14, 1891, a mob of thousands descended on the city jail and attacked the defendants. 11 of them were killed. Several of them were hung from trees and shot outside the jail, while others were beaten to death or shot within the jail. The mob included prominent members of the community, including lawyers, politicians, and business people. To make matters even worse, some of the men who were killed had already been found not guilty of the murder but had been kept in the jail anyway. This mass lynching, which was the largest single lynching incident in American history, showed just how bad anti-Italian sentiment was at that time. This event also likely contributed to the mafia's view on harming law enforcement officials. It was clear from that point forward how much heat doing something like this could bring on an organization. The incident even strained U.S. diplomatic relationships with Italy. Italy demanded justice and payments for the families of the victims. The families ultimately did receive some money from the federal government, but nobody was convicted for the lynching. The entire incident, and more specifically the murder of the police chief, brought the mafia into the minds of Americans for the first time. Hyperbolic writings and papers about Italians pouring into the country to attack Americans fueled anti-Italian feelings in the U.S. Charles Matringa was not killed in the lynchings, and shortly thereafter he returned to New Orleans and resumed his place at the top of the food chain in the New Orleans underworld. By the turn of the century, his family had solidified its position as the most powerful crime group in the city. Charles Matringa began to wind down his involvement with the family and with crime, and eventually he retired in 1922. Corrado Giancona was chosen as his successor. Giancona needed someone to run things on the street, and Silvestro Silver Dollar Sam Carollo was picked for this role. Carollo started working for the Matringa sometime in the early 1900s and had quickly moved up the ranks. Carollo's day job, if you will, was in the restaurant business. But in reality, he was heavily involved in bootlegging, illegal gambling, and numerous other rackets. Just a little side note here, I have read conflicting information on this time period of the New Orleans family, specifically in regards to leadership. I have read that Carollo actually took over as boss directly after Matringa, not Giancona. I have also read that Carollo operated independently of the Matringa organization and fought his way to the top of the food chain in New Orleans. Regardless, it's clear that Carollo had a lot of power in the city after Matringa stepped down. Initially, Carollo focused primarily on expanding the family's bootlegging operations, and he was very successful. By 1930, the family controlled bootlegging for the whole city. Carollo also led the way in modernizing the New Orleans crime family. Up until that point, as I talked about earlier, the family had relied heavily on extorting their fellow Italians, the Black Hand method. Under Carollo, the family relied more on political influence. Carollo had built up relationships with law enforcement and other officials that the family was able to utilize to its advantage. He had legitimate businesses, including bars and cafes. The family slowly started to resemble what you picture when you think of a typical modern mafia family. They were no longer relegated to the fringes of society, but rather they were intertwined in the very fabric of the community, exerting influence whenever and wherever they could. A great example of this was Carollo's work to expand the family's gambling operations. In the 30s, he worked with fellow mobsters to get slot machines installed in the city and with politicians to make sure they could operate without fear of law enforcement. Another example was Carollo's ability to avoid serious jail time for his crimes. For example, he was sentenced to 8 years for killing a narcotics agent in 1933, but ultimately served less than a year thanks to the Louisiana governor ordering his release. The family had clearly built up its political capital in a very short amount of time. Carollo's right-hand man for the gambling operations was Carlos Marcello. As you will hear later, Marcello plays a very significant role in the history of not just the New Orleans family, but the American Mafia as a whole. Corrado Giancona died in 1944, and his underboss, Frank Todaro, took over the family. Todaro died shortly thereafter, allowing Sam Carollo to finally take over as the official boss of the New Orleans crime family. Carollo's time as boss did not play out smoothly. He had been arrested in the late 30s on drug charges that would eventually come back to bite him in a big way. He was ordered to be deported in the early 40s, but this was delayed due to the United States' entrance into World War II. However, in 1947, he actually was deported to Italy. Apparently, any goodwill he had generated had been used up. His tenure as boss had been short-lived and did not match up with the journey he had been on prior to taking the top job. After a brief return to the United States in 1949, he was deported once again. He came back for good in 1970, but he died shortly thereafter. Carlos Marcello took over as boss when Carollo was deported in 1947. Marcello's family had come to the United States in 1911 when he was just a baby. Marcello was involved with crime very early on in New Orleans. He was a small-time thief in those days, but at some point he started working for Carollo. When Marcello took over as boss, he had already been heavily involved in the family's gambling operations. He had worked with other mobsters to facilitate these schemes. This includes Frank Costello, a powerful New York mafia figure. Marcello worked with Costello to implement and control slot machines all throughout the region. Marcello was also involved in the infamous Las Vegas skimming operations. Again, this was due to his relationships with other mobsters and other families. As you can tell, Marcello worked with other mafia figures frequently to achieve his end goals. He had good relationships with the Chicago Outfit and several of the five families. He also had a personal relationship with Santo Traficante Jr., the longtime boss of the Tampa family. Despite his willingness to work with these other mobsters, Marcello was very protective of his territory. He issued an order that no outsiders could come into the region without his permission. Marcello remained at the top of the New Orleans family for more than 30 years. For most of his reign, he had been able to avoid serious run-ins with the law. This was thanks largely to his control of public officials. The U.S. Senate's Kefauver Committee, which was tasked with investigating organized crime in the U.S. in the 50s, found that Marcello had numerous law enforcement officials in Louisiana in his pocket. From that point forward, the federal government was on Marcello like a hawk. He was ordered to be deported, but was able to delay and fight the orders thanks to his lawyers and money. However, he became a prime target of Robert Kennedy's in the early days of JFK's administration. In April 1961, Marcello was reporting for one of his regularly scheduled check-ins with immigration officials. Marcello had previously established a fake claim of citizenship in Guatemala. The feds decided to use this against him and deport him there, on the basis of him being a citizen. He was deported that very same day. Later that April, he was arrested in Guatemala because it turned out his documents were false. He was moved around to several countries after this before making his way back to the United States and was able to fight off deportation for the remainder of his life. Marcello resumed control of crime in New Orleans and resumed his ways of avoiding trouble with the law as well. He spent 6 months in jail in 1966 for assaulting a federal agent, but stayed under the radar for the remainder of the 60s and the 70s. His name was brought up in the JFK assassination investigation in the United States Congress. I discussed this topic in more detail in the Santo Traficante episode, but the overall outcome was that while the House committee found that the mob had the motivations and means to take out Kennedy, there was no evidence of their direct involvement. Marcello's luck ran out when he was hit with a 7-year sentence in 1982. He had been caught up in an investigation by the FBI into bribery and conspiracy in the Louisiana state government. Three FBI agents had posed as insurance executives looking to land big state insurance plans. They offered bribes to do so. Marcello was at the center of this due to the enormous power he wielded over state officials in Louisiana. This made him the obvious choice for facilitating such a scheme. His conviction was ultimately overturned in 1989 and he was released from prison. Marcello had suffered severe health problems while inside, including several strokes, so he did not resume an active role in the family. Marcello lived in the New Orleans area until his death in 1993. He was 83 years old. Thanks to the enormous gains in power and influence the New Orleans family enjoyed during Marcello's time as boss, they officially took on his name and became widely known as the Marcello crime family. Marcello's brother, Joseph Marcello Jr., had taken over as boss of the family in 1983 and stayed in that role until 1990. Apparently, Joseph did not really want the role and did not do the necessary work to keep the organization alive and well. He was replaced in 1990 by Anthony Carollo, son of Silver Dollar Sam Carollo. Anthony helped lead the family into new ventures, fitting of a modern organization. One of the industries Carollo led the family into was video poker. The industry had been legalized in Louisiana, and the mob quickly attempted to find a way to skim profits. The Marcellos purchased video poker machines from Bally Gaming, using companies as fronts to do so. The deal called for Bally to be paid back using profits from the machines, but instead, the mob diverted those profits to themselves. Bally apparently was completely unaware of the mob's involvement, but the feds quickly caught on and launched an investigation, which Bally cooperated with. The investigation revealed that the New Orleans family had worked with other families, including the Gambinos in New York, to set up the scheme. 17 people were indicted in 1994, including Anthony Carollo. The charges ranged from racketeering to illegal gambling and multiple others. Carollo ultimately pleaded guilty to racketeering in 1995 and was imprisoned until 1998. He remained boss of the family while he was in prison. In fact, he stayed in that position until his death in February of 2007. It is unclear who, if anyone, took over after Carollo passed away. It seems as though the family is now largely defunct and no longer active. New Orleans plays a huge role in the history of the Italian-American Mafia. It is widely considered the birthplace of the organization in the United States, and until Carlos Marcello's death, the family was well-connected and had a lot of power and influence in the South. Thank you for listening to Episode 3 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, please be sure to subscribe, and if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. Thanks again, and have a great day.